This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Okay, so this is our special on the Anti-Communist Manifesto, and we're going to go to my friend and mentor, Michael Berry, nationally syndicated radio host Michael Berry, here in just a couple minutes. He's going to interview me. I'm going to be interviewed like I'm super important, but I probably should explain really quickly before we go to Michael why I wrote the book at all, because I am not an author. I need to be clear about this. I am not an author. I have never had any desire to be an author. I still don't want to be an author. There's not going to be a book series, at least I think. There's not going to be a book series coming out. I'm not going to do a book a year or anything like that. I hate to write. I love to talk to you on TV. I like to talk to you on the radio, but I despise writing. Is that weird? Probably is. Like, if you told me I had to sit down and talk to you for an hour on camera, well, I do that every day. I love that. If you told me I had to write 1,000 words about anything, pick a subject, I would have this knot in my stomach, the kind of knot most people get when they have to speak in front of people. You realize that? That's how much I hate to write. And so my buddy, Chris Balfe, my business partner really, Chris Balfe came to me a couple years ago and he said, hey, I want you to write a book. And Chris knows me. He knows I don't want to write a book. He said, I want you to write a book. I said, okay, what about? I don't want to write a book. He said, hear me out. The Anti-Communist Manifesto. Now that I told him was a book I just might write. And so I got with my buddy Nick Rizzuto, my co-author, and what we did was we came up with a book. I can't believe it's a national bestseller now. That's totally weird to me, but we came up with a book, and what it is it lays out the communism here in the United States of America. It lays out how it got here, historically the comparisons, and probably most importantly, it lays out things that you can do about it. You know, it's not just a book like the normal ones are. I hate these kinds of books that just tell you, well, this sucks, that sucks, and that sucks. Best of luck. No, lays out what the problems are and action items for us to do things about them. That's what I like the most about it. Don't tell me the problems, tell me the solutions. That's what the Anti-Communist Manifesto is. And of course, maybe there's some jokes in there. Maybe, just maybe, you'll snicker a few times, but hopefully you enjoyed it. And it is safe for your kids, just like this show, just like everything else. Kids cross country have read it too. It's totally fine for kiddos. All right? All right, so let's see what Michael Berry wants to talk to me about next. You know, a long time ago, actually about 6.5 years ago, I was not doing this for a living. I was selling RVs. This is back when I had hair and a lot less gray in my beard. And I got to know somebody. Big shot, nationally syndicated radio host, Michael Berry. Basically, for me, he was someone I listened to on the radio. And he sends me a message one day and says, hey, come on my show. I get to go on the Michael Berry show. And I'm selling RVs. I'm in the RV dealership. And I'm on Michael Berry's show. It was cool. But it was, it was 20 minutes, and then I hung up and didn't think about it again. And that night, I'm in the Taco Bell drive-thru, and I get a phone call from Michael Berry calling my cell phone, just to BS, just to talk about things. And then we started hanging out, and guess why? You get to watch yours truly here on the first every single day, because Michael Berry told me, you need to give it a shot, give a media career a shot. And so here I am, now you're stuck with me. Joining me now, somebody who has not only pushed me into this, has mentored me every step of the way, my good friend, Michael Berry. Michael, you have such an incredible eye for talent.
I do, yes. I recognized the talent that was Jesse Kelly in our first radio interview. And the rest, as they say, is history. People call me by different names. I had a cap made about this. Yes, and today is a special day because, as I hope you've told your viewers, this is the day that the Anti-Communist Manifesto hits the shelves in paperback form. So the production team and I thought it'd be a good idea if instead of you talking to everybody, I interviewed you. First of all, why write this book?
Why what?
Why write this book?
Well, I don't like to write. You know, I told you that all the time because you were always nagging at me. I got to write more. Why are you not writing more? Because you were always on me about that. You need to write an article about this. You need to get your name out there.
But you were writing, and I was always complaining. For townhall.com, and those were good. And so you clearly have a knack for writing.
Yeah, it was for the Federalist, and I did do some things for Town Hall, and there's a couple other places I forgot. But I hate to write. I've tried to explain this to people. I tried to whine to you about it all the time, and you were nagging at me about it. I don't like to write. My wife did the same thing. She's like, you need to write. I hate writing. I realize people enjoy the things that I write for some reason, probably because I'm stupid and it's easy for everyone to understand. But I don't like to write. I hate to write, and I never wanted to write a book, and I don't ever want to write another one. The idea of writing an anti-communist manifesto because of my hatred for communists was appealing to me. It's the only thing that was appealing to me because Chris Balfe, my good friend, business partner Chris Balfe, begged me forever to write a book too, and I just wouldn't. And finally, he's the one who pitched me on that idea. And I thought, you know, it was like a light bulb came on. As soon as he said it, I thought to myself, wow, that's probably something I could dig into. But even that, for me, was insurmountable. As I told him in the open, Michael, that the feeling most people get when they have to speak in front of people and they get that feeling in the pit of their stomach where you have a moment where you think, I'd rather die than get up in front of people and speak. It's a very human thing. You know, you don't have that anymore. I don't have that anymore, but it's a very natural thing. That's what I feel like if I have to write even 1,000 words. If we hung up here and you called me and said you'd have to write something on the border and get it turned into the Federalist and you're all over me about it, like I would feel borderline physically sick. That's how much I hate writing. But this book meant, the concept of this meant enough to me, and I thought I could maybe do it well, and I thought, well, screw it, you might as well give it a shot. And so now I'm a world-famous author, Michael, world-famous.
Indeed, I can't question it. I thought that the reason for the book was as a delivery mechanism for your burger recipe. I thought it was really just a Trojan horse to get the burger recipe into as many hands as you possibly could. But, you know, on that subject, Rush Limbaugh used to say, after he wrote his second book, he said, there will be no more books. People would ask for more books. And he said, I don't have an iron butt. And I've always liked that line because we sit. You know, you sit and do television. You sit and do radio. When we're done with that, we don't want to sit and write more. And it's hard to imagine, you know, the brain power that requires, the tedium that requires. Like Carol Markowitz, our mutual friend Carol Markowitz. I think she could write in her sleep. It comes very naturally to her. But I think for us, we are communicators by voice and expressive in this way, verbally and not in the written form. So, all kidding aside, hats off to you for finishing the damn thing.
You know, don't you find what you just said kind of weird? Or I find it kind of weird. People like Carol, who can just sit down and just hammer out subject, and in fact, they love it. Like, they enjoy it. I don't get that at all, but Carol, Dave Marcus is this way. These types, just natural writers, can sit down, and it just flows from them. Like, anyone who listens to your radio show can hear it just flows out of you. It's effortless, right? I can't write like that. You know, I can sit. You ask me to sit and talk for 3 hours. I run my mouth for 3 hours. I'll talk about cheeseburgers for 3 hours. But if you ask me to write it down, I don't express myself in that way. And people who have that talent, I'm envious of it. You know, people watch us through radio and TV and think it's all fancy or whatnot, but I'm jealous of the people who can write. If you can sit and write, I wish I could do that. Because that's, in my opinion, yes, exactly. I was about to say, it's longer lasting. You know, long after I'm dead and gone, someone's going to pick up the Anti-Communist Manifesto. They're not going to download the Jesse Kelly Show podcast, but they might pick up the book.
P.J. O'Rourke book, and P.J.'s not around anymore, but I can still laugh at his jokes. You know, songwriters and great artists will say, I've seen them interviewed, and they will say that the greatest compliment they can give to another song is that they hate the person who wrote it because they wish they had written it. I have to tell you, doing what I do, and having done it since long before you were doing it, when you created the language around communism, for what the left is and started shoehorning it into that and giving kind of a structure to, you need to understand, these people aren't just out there in the ether operating. This is a redux of what we've seen before. They are communists. That, I hated you for that, because why couldn't I have thought of that? Because it made it much more understandable and accessible. And I hats off to you for that.
Yeah, well, I study my enemy, right? I mean, we all know this, especially dudes know this, that you study your enemy, what works and what doesn't work. We had the Marines working with the Chi Coms in before World War II to learn about jungle warfare, right? You study your enemy. How does he operate? And one thing that really, really hit me as I watched, you know, you watch enough of the news and read enough crap and you're watching videos on social media, it really hits you how purposeful the communist is with his language. So incredibly purposeful. Discipline, he demands the discipline of his fellow communists. Go ahead and watch a CNN panel where you have a bunch of Democrats on there and watch even one of them call an illegal. Well, an illegal. He will be, we've all seen it a million times, he or she will be scolded by his fellow communists. Well, we don't say that word here. We'd like to use the word undocumented. Why are they so purposeful about it? Because language leads to mindset, you know, leads to mindset, and mindset leads to performance. So if you want the American people to be more accepting of importing millions of foreign barbarians, you don't call them illegals, you call them undocumented, and then it sounds like Lupe tripped over the border to have 18 kids here instead of purposely invading the country, which is what she did, to have all of her kids become American citizens. So they are purposeful with how they speak, and I didn't like how unpurposeful, I'm sure that's not a word. You know, Michael, I didn't go to college. I didn't like how unpurposeful the right was, because most of us, obviously it's not universal, come from a place of honesty, right? You want to be honest. We care about the truth and facts and things like that. So we just speak, you know, we just talk. But the communist is framing everything. He's framing it, he's labeling it, he's branding everything, which is something you're always riding me about, is branding. He's branding. We're being branded as Nazis, as white supremacists, as this and that, because he's focused with his language. And I did not like our lack of focus and decided to attempt in my own small way to try to focus things. That's why.
The Anti-Communist Manifesto is out today in paperback, the more affordable version, with Jesse's famous burger recipe at the end. Tell me what reaction you received from readers, because you read your emails, we talked about this for a long time, from your TV viewers, you read your emails from your listeners. What was a reaction to the book that you received that surprised you or you at least didn't expect?
Well, you know how we just talked about how I don't like writing? Every single thing I ever wrote, you know, a little article for the Federalist, every single thing I ever wrote, when I was done writing it, I hated it. I would read it several times, and I would think, this is slop. It's not intelligent. It's not entertaining. And, you know, what do? You send it to family. You know, you send it to your mom. I would send it to my mom. But what's your mom going to say? Oh, it's the greatest thing I've ever read in my life. But even still, nothing cured the fact that I hated it. When Nick Rizzuto and I wrote this book, when it was finally done, we did this long weekend meetup where we kind of ripped up and rewrote this, and I didn't like the wording here, so we're rewriting all this stuff, and we have the finishing touches on it. And I read through the entire thing again when it was done. I thought it sucked. I really genuinely thought it sucked. I thought the stuff that he did, you know, the research, the facts, was so fascinating because I nerd out on that. But I really genuinely thought it sucked. And everyone knows I'm not being fake humble. I'm the least humble person in the world. I just don't think I write well. And so I read the book and I thought, this is garbage. It's garbage. It's going to be another one of those books that somebody, some conservative writes, and it gets published, but then it disappears into the ether after a few days because it really kind of freaking sucked. That really was 100% what I thought was going to happen. And then, boom, it just takes off. And it's national bestseller. And it's this, and people are emailing the show. It's one of the best books I've ever read. I bought 5 copies. I'm handing it to friends and family. And to this day, it's the most surprised I've ever been. In my 6.5 years of doing media, the most surprised by a mile I've ever been has been the listener and viewer reaction to the book, how much it was universal. I don't think I got one from a listener that said, it wasn't very good. They just did backflips over the whole thing. I still don't get it. I still think it sucks. But everyone loves it. So there it is.
Talking about the perpetuity in which a book can be kept, right? That was Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, is burn all the books and you burn all the knowledge, because that's how we pass from generation to generation. We can go back and read Hemingway. We can go back and read Shakespeare. We can go back into history and read the words of people that we don't meet. But what's fascinating about a book, and I think that's why it was important you did this, I think what makes it so amazing is you and I and everybody watching you is part of a movement to take back our country, to improve the lives of our children and grandchildren, to make America great again. I mean, that really means something, right? That's why Reagan first came up with it. But the idea of our movement and how we communicate and educate and share, we have radio. You and I do radio every evening. And so that's people while they're driving mostly, or, you know, they're in their podcast ears. Then we have television, and that's mostly when you're at home and you can watch it on your TV. But there is, in a book, there is an opportunity to reduce to writing a thought, a concept, the tenets of the movement in this case, which is what you set out, and to be able to share that with people, and to be able to do that in a way that you can say, Jesse, it's your birthday, I bought this book from this guy, or Billy, it's your birthday, I bought this book from this guy, read it, it's great. And they may not be able to get them to listen to your radio show or watch your television show, but they will share that. And there's something kind of cool about that. It's another part of the movement.
Yeah, it's like another tool in your tool belt. I totally agree. And I've always loved quotes. You know, everyone does, right? Who doesn't love a great quote? But I have, as uneducated and dumb as I am, I have all these endless quotes from various authors and historical figures burned into my head because they were written down. I mean, who doesn't know the John Adams quote, I study war and politics so my sons can study mathematics and philosophy? Like, how profound and freaking awesome is that? It's a quote that's just like, yeah. And when it's written, it's more meaningful. And just talking about this, I think about this a lot. People will talk about Rush Limbaugh to this day, the GOAT, the greatest of all time. I miss Rush. Rush is the best. And of course he was. And one of the wild things about it is you could listen to Rush Limbaugh for 3 hours a day and you were entertained and you were informed and you were all those things, all that stuff is true. But when I see Rush Limbaugh quotes, people will still put them up on Twitter or Facebook or something like that. You'll read a Rush Limbaugh quote and you'll think, man, that is profound. That is as profound as any conservative writing I've ever read in my life. I guess it didn't make the same impact on me because I was listening to it at the time, or maybe I was half listening. You know how it is with a radio audience, they're mostly half listening. So it didn't make an impact on me when I heard it. But when I read it, I thought, man, that is as deep and wonderful as anything that you can write.
Because it's been reduced to writing.
Writing it down, yes. Ranging it, what'd you say?
Because it's been reduced to writing. When you reduce something to writing,
right,
it gives it a gravitas that having been spoken alone. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned your mom, and you know that's what moms are for. They cheer for us. So a few months ago, I lost my mom, and a matter of days later, you lost your dad. But your dad did get to see the hardback edition. Obviously, the paperback is out today. What was your dad's reaction? Because you and your dad have a very interesting relationship.
You know, first, he texted the group family text the day the book was published. So, you know, Simon & Schuster, big shot book publisher, they published the book, and I'm grateful they did it, and it becomes this national bestseller. And he's not a big texter, as you can imagine. My old man was rough around the edges. And he texted the group chat, and he said, I can't believe he actually wrote a book after failing algebra 3 times in college. So, but that was his love language, right? And other than that, He would tell me he was proud of me occasionally, but most of my stories from him, I would get secondhand because my dad wasn't the lovey-dovey type with me, so I wouldn't get as much from him. But I would get all the time from my mom and sister that he would brag to strangers, total strangers who didn't give a crap about me or the book. He's telling them, well, my son, yeah, he wrote a book. It's big. It's national bestseller. You should go buy it. He'd bully perfect strangers into buying the book, completely proud of the whole thing. Just didn't tell me that much about it. And that was the way he was. He was something.
You're a Marine. You're a tough guy. Not as tough as your dad, but tough like your dad. And he's what made you tough. Very, very tough man. An oak in the forest. We struggle as men to cope with grief, right? And we're not as expressive as women. It's a difficult mm-hmm. It's a difficult thing. Let's talk about that. So you get the news that your dad passed, and we've had this conversation. It hit you maybe harder than you would have ever imagined. How did that change you? What advice do you have for people who go through these? Because we're guys, we don't grieve easily or well.
Well, I'll tell you, it's a process. It's a process I'm still going through. So I certainly don't want to pretend like I'm an expert on it. I can only tell people what I've gone through. It comes in waves. You know, it comes and it goes. You know, I'll wake up one morning. It was this morning, and I feel great. I still miss him, but feel great going through the workday. Even talking about him right now, fine, totally fine. So it's not like that triggers it or something like that. Talking, you're fine, everything's fine. But it could be tomorrow morning. I may wake up and I don't feel like getting out of bed. And the grief will come and it will go and it will come and it will go. But the difference between, you know, I'm sure this is a big men and women thing, as you just alluded to, is the talking about it. I have no problem, you know, telling my wife when I'm grieving. But oftentimes I don't tell her. She can just tell. She'll see it right on my face when I walk home when I walk in the door or when I wake up in the morning. She can see it if I'm making breakfast. And then she'll always ask me, because this is her way, do you want to talk about it? And occasionally I have wanted to, but for the most part, no. The answer is no. I don't want to talk about it. And it's not that I'm trying to bottle everything up. Sometimes men have to grieve alone. You know, there's nothing I can say. There's nothing I can say. There's no way I can convey what I'm thinking or feeling. And frankly, I don't feel like it. And the best advice I could give to people if they're going through any grief is, that's okay. If you want to talk about it, that's okay. You want to gather with friends, that's okay. You want to go be in a cabin by yourself in the woods for a couple weeks while you grieve, that's okay. Everyone grieves differently in their own way, and it's totally fine. I don't pass judgment on how my friends and family are grieving. They don't pass it on me, and that's the best advice I can give. If I want to be alone, I'll be alone. If I want to take the day off of work, I will. If I want to go home and have an extra whiskey, I might. But grieve in your own way.
So I preach, and I literally preach this almost daily, that because I have known of people who lose a loved one. My brother died 3 years ago. He was 54 years old. He was an active duty police officer, and I get the call, and he's passed. And so we didn't get that last conversation, but we literally talked every day. And I tell people, you don't know when you walk out the door and that door slams behind you and you throw that last zinger, hurt them as much as you can, that may be the last thing you ever say to that person. And I've known people for whom that was the case. And I say, no matter what happens, and my wife and I have a rule, we do not separate without I love you in a meaningful way, because if that's the last thing I ever say to her, I don't want there to be any doubt that I worry that she doubted. You and your dad had a special moment there the last time you talked, which is almost, I mean, you talk about God's hand on us. That was sort of a very unique moment. So if you're good with it, I think people should hear that story. I think they should see that side of you.
All right, let's see if I can get through this. So my dad, it's just a Kelly thing. I'm the exact same way. My dad did not stay in other people's homes when he would visit out of town. The Kellys don't do that. You don't stay in other people's homes. Look, I'm not defending it. It was just our way. You don't stay in other people's homes. You go visit. You have your dinner. You go. Then if you're out of town, you go to a hotel or you go back home. You don't stay with other people. And this included me. It's his son. You know, I have Ob. We have the two boys. He was the best grandpa. Just love those boys. But he would come down, and, you know, we'd have dinner, and we'd have, and then he'd go to a hotel with my mom. They'd go. He wouldn't stay. So I have a theory. I don't know this, but I have a theory that my father knew he was dying. I think a doctor told him. He's not the type who would pass that along, because the last time I saw him, he came down to visit us in Texas for a week, and he stayed with us. A week? My dad won't stay with you for a night. There were instances where he would come in, fly in, and they were going to have to come stay at the house to stay with the boys, and he would still go to a hotel for one night and then get up and come back with us. But for this week, he said, I'm staying with you. Never happens. He brought down a couple hunting knives for the boys. Never happens. My dad doesn't do that sentimental stuff, really. And we went out fishing. We went fishing. Went fishing for redfish one morning. Saturday, it was Saturday morning. We went fishing for redfish. Got up. Me, him, the boys went out fishing. Didn't catch much, but had a blast listening to him yell at the boys, and everything was great. We finished with that. We go eat a big Cajun meal. Found this Cajun place. We love to eat. My dad's just like me. We just love to eat. Of course, I got that from him. We made pigs of ourselves. And that night, it was playoff baseball. Dodgers were playing somebody. Forget who. Maybe the Padres, somebody. Dodgers were playing somebody. And I was sitting there on the couch. My dad had, of course, taken over my recliner. He comes in and takes over my recliner, so I'm sitting on the couch. And we're watching the baseball game, just me and him. And I just turned to him and I told him I loved him, right? That was, I mean, it was something we said, but not often, not often. Just out of the blue, told him I loved him. Turns to me, tells me he loves me too. That was Saturday night. I hug him, kiss him goodnight, say goodbye. I did not get up in time to see him the next morning. They were leaving super early. He got up, him, my mom took off. He went home that night on Sunday night, told my mom that I had told him I loved him and how much that meant to him, and then went to bed and died in his sleep that night. God is good.
There is your reminder to each and every person that we just don't know when that last moment's going to occur, and live your life accordingly. I mean, that's as beautiful as it gets. How much of the person you are politically? I know you're a miniature version of him in the way you're grumpy and you're not expressive, but you're tough and you're dutiful and all that. How much of your politics, looking back now, because he's very much a self-made man, as you are, how much of your politics do you attribute to things you heard him say or how you watched him live?
Oh, a lot of it. And what's funny is he wasn't political. We were not a political family. I didn't grow up political. The only political conversation I ever remember having with my parents, and I'm not kidding, it is the only one. I think I was in kindergarten, maybe the first grade. George H.W. Bush was running for president. And in our class, we had a mock election, right? And there were Democrats and Republicans, and you could, you know, it was just grade school, stupid grade school stuff. And I didn't even know what I was or what we were. So I went home that night and I asked my parents, are we Democrats or Republicans? And I remember my dad, plain as day, turning and saying, we're Republicans. And that was it. There was no explanation. You know, there was no deep political philosophy around it. But then, you know, you watch him bust his butt and work that hard. He's a construction man. We're a construction family. His dad worked construction. That's what he does. You watch him bust his butt no matter what. You watch the guy go to work no matter what, cold, hot, busting his rear end his whole life, hard work, toughness, no whining. And you may not have, you know, been reading about Ronald Reagan and Winston Churchill from your dad, but you grow up one day and you figure out, wow, that was framing how you view the world, you know, in its own way, framing how you view the world will take you to where you need to be politically. If your dad's a worthless loser freeloader and raises you to be that way, you're probably going to be a Democrat. If your dad believes in hard work and success and no whining, you're going to fall somewhere on the right. Maybe you'd be a libertarian or a nationalist or a conservative or something like that, but you're going to be somewhere on the right. So there's that, and really what I have to politically, at least as far as my career goes, to thank him for, beyond the lessons about hard work, it's being unapologetic about who you were. He is, my sister said at his funeral, and it was so true, that she'd never met anybody in her life as unapologetically who he was as my dad was. And people will say things to me like, oh man, that was brave. I can't believe you said that. That took a lot of courage, which I find to be ridiculous. It's not courageous to say things on TV and radio. You know, cops are courageous, troops are courageous, but to whatever degree you believe that, wow, that really took guts. Well, it's not that it took guts. I really genuinely just don't care if you're angry about it. It's not even that I'm happy you're angry or sad you're angry. It means nothing to me whatsoever. This is how I feel, so this is how I talk, and you can take it or leave it. It really genuinely doesn't mean anything to me at all. That's the Kelly way, and that's really one of the main things I learned from him, I'd say.
Do you know who famously said, imagine how much good you can do in the world if you stop caring what other people think about you? Me.
No.
That's my quote. It's on my wall. It's the only one I expect to be remembered for, if you'll keep saying it years after I'm gone. I have said to you jokingly over the years that you're dead inside. And it is joking, partly. But I do think there is a certain skill set to come back to the anti-communist manifesto. There is a skill set to taking back our country, because I hate that people think that Trump's going to solve all our problems. He's doing his part. We did our part to help him get elected. But we're the heads of household. We're the heads of businesses. We're the parents of kids that are in schools. We're serving on juries. We're going to have to take this country back. And part of that means being a little dead inside to the emotions of other people. We have to be, it comes naturally to you because you genuinely don't care what other people think. We have been taught by mommies and school teachers who are mommies at school for our entire lives that we have to be nice to everyone. No, you've got to do the right thing. And that's what I like about the book, that the message is understand these bastards, understand what you're dealing with, understand who they are, and you unapologetically call them that. And now once you understand who they are, understand we're in a war and how we're going to win. And I think that is the point, that's the real takeaway from this book, that I think it has a chance to make a difference with.
It's why I wrote the action items. Every single chapter has a subject with history and everything else, but at the back end of it, it has action items, things you can do, right? It's not just here's a problem and that's a problem and that's a problem. It's things you can do. And the boldness to do something is required. And the reason, it is a great aid that I am that way, that I was raised that way. It is a great aid when fighting communists, because communists are masterful at using your values and your emotions against you. It's the, you know, they're banking on when your liberal Aunt Peggy walks into your Super Bowl party and she starts bragging about her 15th abortion and talking about why we need all the foreign barbarians in the country. The normal reaction from the right would be something similar to what you would expect your wife to say. She'd lean in, look at you and say, please don't embarrass me. Why? Because she wants to maintain peace, lets everything calm down, let's just walk away from it. But that is how the communist wins. That please don't embarrass me attitude from us, that has turned him into the only aggressor in every single social setting. And so he's moved the culture his way, because liberal Aunt Peg is the only one screaming, no more don't embarrass me. No more be nice about it. No more roll your eyes and go to the other room. No more of that. No. You put that commie hag witch in her place right then and there and tell her if she doesn't like it, she can pack up her tampons and her cat litter and she can get back in her Subaru Outback and never come back in the house again. Start treating the communist like the rat demon vermin that he is, and stop treating him like just some kind of lost, naive child who will slowly come around if you're just kind enough to him. That does not work with communists. They're religious zealots. They only understand fear and pain. And so you have to be the one to give that to them.
You said earlier, know your enemy. And I think what you do a great job in the book at is explaining who these people are and understanding you can't wait on them to stop beating you. You've got to fight back. You can't roll over and hope they stop what they're doing. And I love that as part of it, because we have what I call the nice neighbor problem. We all want to be the nice neighbor, no matter how loud the music gets, the gunshots get, the pit bull coming on. I mean, at some point, you have to push back and say, enough is enough. And that's probably my favorite part is you explaining, and you kind of alluded to it there, that the communist is not, these aren't just random people who happen to share some ideas and vote the same way. This is a mindset which is a replacement for religion. They are zealots. They are committed. And when you understand what you're up against then, that's, there are fewer of them, but that's why they win so often.
Yeah, well, the problem is when it comes to, you know, people love that old saying, it takes two to tango. Well, that is not the case when it comes to war, whether that be actual kinetic war or cultural wars or political wars. It only takes one side. And your liberal Aunt Peggy, she believes she's a warrior and she believes she's at war. So no matter what you think about that, you're at war. She has already declared war. She is fighting a war. She's fighting it as if it's a war that she must win. And so whether or not you like that or agree with that means nothing whatsoever. One side has decided there's going to be a war. So now you have to fight it as if it is a war. And she fights it as if she intends to win it, all in, all the time. And that's something I try to get through to people in the book, is we can't be as laissez-faire about power as we always have been. Oh, sure, we'll show up and vote for Donald Trump once every 4 years, but then local school board election, I'm too busy, I got soccer practice tonight, I can't be bothered with this, I can't be bothered with that. That's exactly why you have these red cities and red areas that are run by vicious little commie monsters putting trannies in the public library to shake his penis in front of your child, because you abstain from power and liberal Aunt Peggy did not. She's not abstaining from anything. She drives around like a freaking predator looking for choke points of power to seize, and we have to understand they're around us. They're seizing these choke points, and we have to take them back.
Your viewers are watching you mostly talk about national issues. But President Trump the other day signed a bill that said no more boys in women's sports. Turns out 80%, it was technically 79% of Americans do not want boys in girls' sports. What we're talking about now are local family community issues, not national issues. We talk the national issues on national broadcast, but at the end of the day, and I will applaud you for this, you have said again and again, the most important election that you will participate in is not presidential, it is your local school board. You should participate in all of them. And understanding that the communist is most active where the rubber hits the road, in the local school, at the local city government. And I think that is another important thing. For those who haven't read the book, that's a point you make again and again. Get involved locally, not just where you see the national stories.
Every single person has the ability and should get involved in some way. If you are not doing any kind of political activism, you are flat out wrong. And that doesn't mean you have to run for Congress or Senate or whatever. I live in an extremely red area of Texas, and I went to a school board meeting. This is a few months back. It was a school board forum. There were 5 school board seats. So we're talking about control of the school board. And I show up, probably 150, 200 people there at this thing. And I'm gabbing with one of the local elected leaders in the back, one of the Republicans who knows who I am, and we're there. I'm asking him about the demographics of the crowd or their political leanings of the crowd. And he starts laughing and he said, it's a school board meeting, probably 95% Democrats. Here we are, blood red area, MAGA flags everywhere, Trump this, Trump that, I love Trump, go America, woo! But the school board that's going to determine whether Aiden, Jaden, and Braden learn that they're gay in the 5th grade, that school board, completely occupied by commies, and it's commies there figuring out which commie they want on the school board while we sit at home, church, soccer, work, ignoring the real choke points of power, and that we cannot do anymore. We have to go take back everything, legally and locally.
Well, and that's the point of the Anti-Communist Manifesto. That's what I take away from it, is understanding how committed these people are. I really still think, and that's why I hope people will read the book, I really still think people are underestimating who these people are. Oh, my sister, we're just a little different. No, you have to understand. You know, I'm a student of the Civil War, and I know that's not, of all the military activity you follow, it's probably not your top one. It is for me. And I am in constant shock at how the Confederate forces, underfed, undertrained, undermanned, were able to fight so efficiently, effectively, against the Union Army that had better food, weaponry, training, the whole thing, because the Southern folks were much more committed. It wasn't about slavery, it was about protecting their own community, and we can argue over that all day. But you study these things, and it's like in Jericho in the Bible, they are fighting with just a viciousness, and it mattered on the battlefield. These communists, and it might be our sister-in-law, it might be our kid's teacher, they're fighting with a viciousness. And you point that out, I think too few people that do what we do either understand it or are willing to say it in that way.
Well, when you say it, when you allow your mind to go there, then what you do is you've accepted the fact that you're at war. And that's the real holdup for most people. They don't want to live their life like that. They don't want to live in constant conflict. They don't want to have to get involved, even locally. They don't want to have to get screamed at. They don't want to have to do these things. People in America want to just, and this is a very natural human thing, I'm not dogging on Americans, we just want to exist. Can't I just go to work? Why do you have to, this stuff shouldn't even be in school. Why do I have to fight this stuff in school? What, I shouldn't have to, it's a lot of that. You shouldn't have to. But we sat back and laid back for so long, we let the demons take over everything. Well, now you have to. It's not an option to not be involved. But the hesitancy to acknowledge that the pink-haired freak in your child's second grade class with the Black Lives Matter flag up there, it's hard to just accept that that is actually a child predator who is teaching your child for the express purpose of shattering your child and breaking them away from you. That's a fact.
Jesse, since I'm running the show today, your folks are telling me we're out of time. I appreciate you, my man. I love the book. Everybody should buy it. It's out in paperback today. Very proud of you, my man.
Thank you, my brother. As always, thank you for everything. We'll be back. Well, that was my friend and mentor, Michael Berry. As you can tell, we've known each other for quite some time. And look, you know what this special was? This is me telling you about the book. Go buy it. If you can't afford it, I realize that's the case. Talk to a friend. See if a friend has it. Go down to your local library and request they get it. We've had many people across the country in the last year or two do that. They've gone down, basically demanded their library order it. So everyone is in a different financial situation, but I think you'll enjoy it. I think your friends will enjoy it. Even kids can enjoy it. You will laugh. You will learn. JesseKellyBook.com is where you go buy it. If you want to go buy it there, go. Buy the paperback. Enjoy.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.